Hi, I'm Caitlin Prest, and I am here in your ear to tell you about a very incredible new show called Asking For It. Asking For It is a darkly comedic series that follows a queer femme singer whose history of violence finds her no matter how many times she runs away. It has an original soundtrack, and it'll make you laugh, cry, and feel a little bit less alone. Asking For It. Subscribe now.
This is a CBC podcast.
What's it like for you guys to come back to this house?
It's been a little more difficult, but it's something that we've got to deal with, you know. So at this point now, it's just about getting things together for the grandchildren, for their future and whatever they want, eh? Go in, my boy.
Brian Sweeney ushers his grandson Wyatt into the little white house in Sault Ste. Marie. Several generations of Sweeneys have called it home. Brian grew up here, and when his daughter Wyatt's mom, Angie, took it over, he always dropped by for visits and her home cooking. Now, a cardboard box of Angie's shoes sits by the door.
How much of Angie is still here?
Quite a bit, actually. Like, this was what my daughter was all about, you know. She had all kinds of nice sayings on the wall, you know, that cheer you up every day.
Almost everywhere you turn, there are inspirational quotes. The kitchen walls urge you to use kind words, give hugs and kisses. And there's one recurring word, love.
She was all about love. Every chance we had to get together for birthdays and have a barbecue and whatever, she always got everybody together. That was the way she was. And that's what she's doing now. You know, and in this tragedy, she's brought us all back together again. I need a bit.
It's okay.
It's been just over 4 months since Brian Sweeney's daughter was killed. Fresh waves of grief still overtake him. 16-year-old Wyatt is more stoic.
Wyatt, do you have memories of her in this kitchen?
A lot. Too many to really recount any of them.
When you're in this space, do you feel close to her?
Kinda. I think she's somewhere better than here, at least. I hope.
On October 23rd, 2023, Bob Hallert, a man with a history of intimate partner violence, shot and killed Angie Sweeney days after she broke up with him. They'd been together for about 3 years. Hallert then drove to another ex's house and shot and killed their three children, seriously injured their mother, and then turned the gun on himself. I'm Katie Nicholson, and this is Storylines. What happened that day didn't just shatter the Sweeney family, it shattered Sault Ste. Marie. Now, Angie's friends, family, and community have come together to grieve, but also to act, because they believe what happened to Angie could have been stopped. That with the right laws and policies in place, intimate partner violence, which is at a record high in Canada, could end. And that the roadmap to the end of IPV has already been written, many times over through multiple inquests, and then largely ignored. A heads up, this story includes descriptions of verbal and physical violence.
Are you guys okay to talk a little bit about the lead up to,
sure.
to what happened?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was having problems with drug abuse, and my mom was not having that. So she got him off of all of that, and then right before, like 3 days before what happened, she figured out that he failed a drug test at work and kicked him out.
With his mop of dark curls and an oversized hoodie, Wyatt still looks like a teenager, but he's the size of a grown man. He plays football. He and Hallert clashed from the start over things like cutting the grass.
There was one time we were in the kitchen and he ran at me. And I stopped him dead in his tracks and just pushed him right out the door. And then when we got outside, he was telling me to, like, hit him. Like, he was so immature. That's the best way to describe him. He wasn't a grown man at all.
Wyatt decided to move in with his grandparents, Brian and Suzanne. But a week before she died, Angie told her mom it was time for Wyatt to come home.
she said she would cut the grass herself just to have him back home with them as a family. It's like she finally caught on and realized that what this man was contributing to her life was not what her life was all about. She was probably showing more rejection to him, and that could have been part of the trigger as well.
Angie's friends never liked Bob Hallard much. Her best friend since childhood, Lindsay Stewart, takes me along one of the many trails she and Angie love to walk. She remembers her reaction when she found out who Angie was dating.
So I knew Bob even prior to them starting to date. And back then, I didn't care for him. He was always, you know, creating fights at parties and just a rough guy. It was in March 2020, she had texted me and she said, "I found the love of my life." And right away I told her, run for the hills. It was right in the thick of COVID, and she obviously decided to stick through it.
Were there warning signs to your mind that...
Yeah. And her family and friends, you know, were always there for her and telling her that she deserves better. And she knew it. And near the end, she was trying to get out of the relationship, and I think the system maybe failed her a little bit.
Among the most disturbing elements of this tragedy is that it's not unique. A woman is killed by an intimate partner on average every 6 days in Canada. For Angie's friends and family, one case stands out for its eerie parallels to what happened here in the Sioux.
For several hours today, Eastern Ontario was the scene of an intense manhunt. Police were searching for an armed suspect.
Renfrew County, Ontario, September 2015. In the space of a few hours one morning, a man killed three women at three different addresses. Anastasia Kuzik, Natalie Warmerdam, and Carol Colleton.
The Ontario Provincial Police say they've arrested a suspect who may be linked to three murders. All the victims are women.
A month-long inquest into that triple femicide made 86 recommendations to end intimate partner violence. The recommendations spanned everything from ways to improve the justice system, the criminal code, early interventions for victims and perpetrators, more and better resources for those in danger, and better police and public education.
Oh, and one thing, Angie was like a wild driver, so when... That's an understatement.
Renee Buxel, Amanda Bjarna, and Lindsay all sit around a table at the Breakfast Pig, where Angie loved to go for brunch. They huddle over a picture from an 80s party.
That's me, Angie, and Miranda.
So this was our wolf pack, and so together, like, all of the time.
The bonds in this pack have become tighter as the women try to piece together what happened and what might have saved their friend's life. Amanda saw red flags early on. The friends were on a camping trip for the Canada Day weekend. Bob and Angie had a fight.
It was July 1st. We went camping. Their first big fight. Texted her like insanity all night. We tried trunk phones. He tried texting other people. And then the next morning it was like, "Hey, do you want a cup of coffee?" And we're like, we tried to point out, like, "Angie, this isn't normal behavior. This isn't okay." But then he was. Anybody too will tell you that he could charm you and he could talk to you. And then she just was like, I'm not going to give up. If everybody just gave up on everybody in life, then what kind of people would be out there? And then it was hard to fight or argue with her because that's why we loved her, and that's what she's seen in everybody. So it was like, we got to keep giving him a try, right? And so try to downplay it a lot.
Renee remembers how Hallard talked to Angie.
Because he was definitely abusive, I think, but more so with, like, his words.
Yeah,
like,
mentally,
he would mentally, like, belittle her and put her down and tell her she was fat and disgusting and nobody would want her. And, you know, so at that point, he was really good at, like, making her feel worthless without actually getting physical with her. And then in September was the first time that he did, like, actually hit her, and she left and she went to our friend Tress's house. She left barefoot, actually. She showed up at Tress's house with no shoes on.
Angie, like many abuse survivors, kept that assault under wraps. She didn't report it to police. By October, Angie's mind was made up. She needed to break up with Hallard for good.
She called me. She's like, "I'm changing my locks on my house. He's done. I'm going to pack up all of his stuff and put it into his camper. we went to her house and he still had his video cameras up.
Hallard had installed the cameras around Angie's house ostensibly to ward off thieves, but then he used them to monitor her.
He would sit at work and watch them. And then I don't think she realized at first either that he could hear everything too.
Monitoring a partner is a component of coercive control, one of the more subversive forms of abuse, and one the Renfrew inquest suggests the Canadian government make a part of the criminal code. Hallard's anger grew that weekend, and she called police to keep him away. The police then escorted Hallard back to Angie's house to pick up his freezer. It's a decision that Angie's friends and family find bewildering.
He couldn't care about his freezer. He just wanted one more chance to, like, intimidate her, or, you know, like, get his voice into her head one more last time.
When Angie blocked Hallard on every app, he left handwritten notes outside her door in angry scrawls. An hour before he killed her, he found another way to message her, by sending her tiny e-transfers with vulgar messages attached. Heads up. This might be upsetting.
And then he says, "Stupid bitch, I heard everything on the camera. You and Amanda, your last phone call, you shallow piece of shit, trying to lead me on like a fucking clown. You, I hate you."
That message attached to an Interac e-transfer for 1 cent. In the months since Angie's murder, there have been a lot of what ifs. What if this had happened, or what if that had been available? The recommendations of the Renfrew inquest came out a year before Angie was killed. Some were rejected outright, others the province wanted to mull over, and some are slowly being implemented. For Brian Sweeney, it's been a call to action. At his daughter's vigil, just days after her murder, in front of a crowd clutching candles, standing in the cold and rain, he made a promise.
"I've got to do something so that no other family in this country will suffer the way that my family, my girls, all my daughter's girlfriends are all my girls, and they are going to be part with me to get a movement going here to stop all this terrible nonsense and violence. I am going to ask our Mr. Ford if he could find some time of day, because I would have a conversation with him and have a few suggestions."
What would you say to Mr. Ford right now about these recommendations still on the table?
"Get your butt out of the chair and let's get things going here, because none of the recommendations, as far as I see, that are principal to this and prevention are being taken seriously. He's got some girls of his own, and I'm sure he wouldn't like to wake up the middle of some night and get a call that something happened like that to one of his own children."
Recommendation number one is to declare intimate partner violence an epidemic. While nearly 100 communities in Ontario have done it, the Ford government has not. The federal justice minister has referred to it as an epidemic, but so far, the prime minister has refused to make that declaration. Both governments say they are working on implementing some of the inquest recommendations. And in December, Ontario launched a new program called STANDS that it hopes will improve prevention and public education about intimate partner violence, though many of the details are still being worked out. The federal government says, in addition to its support of the new coercive control bill making its way through the House, it's looking at how it can strengthen the way the criminal justice system deals with femicides. Angie's friends all have ideas for what could have helped.
"I just feel like our community doesn't have any outlet for friends and family of IPV or violence, right? I don't really even know what the answer is, but like somewhere just to reach out to, like for friends and family, where a lot of times I felt like, you know, people would be like, oh, well, have her call, or like, you can call the police. For me, they'd be like, oh, well, you can't really just tell us things that you feel are happening, right?"
What Amanda is talking about is bystander intervention resources. That's part of Recommendation 23, which suggests, among other things, the province embark on a public education campaign to help people spot warning signs, especially in rural communities. Lindsay Stewart wishes things had been handled differently when Angie called the police.
"It would have been helpful if they would have took him and held him for maybe 48 hours, I would say. Give Angie time to figure out a plan moving forward without him. Maybe hook him up with a psychologist or some kind of therapy and talk him through his emotions. I think that could have made a difference."
Police say they didn't have grounds to detain Hallard that weekend, but Lindsay's suggestion that Hallard get counseling also gets to the heart of a number of the Renfrew recommendations targeting the perpetrator. Recommendation 32 even suggests a province-wide 24/7 hotline for men in crisis. That has not been implemented. Over the years, Hallert had assaulted two police officers in Ontario and smashed the rear window of a cop car. Even though he hadn't had a valid firearms license since 2014, he still had access to guns. In 2020, before he started dating Angie, Sioux police seized two firearms from him. The friends wish police had done more to keep closer tabs on Hallert.
The cops know the type of person they're dealing with when they get a call for him. So to not like have more serious actions or, you know, make sure that there's no weapons, like there was so much that was done wrong in this situation.
Ontario is considering legislation that exists elsewhere, which would allow police to warn a woman if she was seeing someone with a history of intimate partner violence. We need to take a quick break. Storylines. We'll be right back.
I'm Jonathan Goldstein, host of Wiretap. Each week you're invited to listen in on my telephone conversations, whether funny, sad, wistful, or even slightly strange. You never know just what you might hear on Wiretap.
I mean, I knew you had a show. I just didn't think that people actually listened to it.
Howard,
that's the breadth of your genius, Jonathan. It's not just that you're funny, but you can be cripplingly, poignantly depressing.
The Wiretap Archives, available on CBC Listen, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
The night of October 23rd, Brian got a call telling him that his granddaughter, Angie's 10-year-old, was at the police station. He didn't know why or what she was doing there.
Well, then when we got up there, we seen Bob's parents in the front corridor of the police station.
Seeing Bob Hallert's parents there, Brian knew something bad had happened.
The first thing his mother had said is, how is Angie? Is she okay? And then I lost it. I jumped in the car, and I'll tell you, if it took me 2 minutes to get down here, that's all it took. I was driving pretty fast, probably crazy, because at that point I was just short of losing my mind, wondering what was going on. Then when I got here, the police had the road blocked off. The police officer told me, he says, well, you can't go in there. He says, it's an investigation now. And I didn't even make it to the driveway. And he says, don't make me have to take you away from here. And I just turned and looked at him. And I said, all I want is one answer from you. I said, is it bad? He said, it's real bad. And then I knew that was it. She had been taken away from us. And so then I just got back in my car and cried my way back to the police station.
Angie was folding laundry in her daughter's room when she heard Hallert kick in the back door. Brian believes Angie saved her daughter's life.
She made a point to hide her underneath the bed and use her body to block the doorway upstairs in the bedroom.
Hallert shot Angie through the door. Back on the boardwalk along St. Mary's River, Lindsay Stewart can't stop replaying the day Angie was killed, because she was nearly there.
So the day that she had passed away, she had called me. She said, can you come over? Like, I'd love to chat with you.
Yeah.
And I said, can we do it tomorrow? I just got back from a hockey tournament and I'm exhausted. And she said, yeah, of course.
What do you think would have happened if you had gone over there that night?
I ask that question all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know if he would have like just kept driving because he saw my car, or if I would have got shot myself. I definitely would have been there at the time where she was shot. I wonder if I would have realized the severity of it and got her and her daughter out to safety prior. It's hard to know, but that is something that weighs heavy on me and I think about often.
Because it's hard to turn that off, right?
Yeah, I don't think I have.
Yeah.
Made my peace with it yet.
Hi, Katie.
Hey.
Come on in.
Thank you.
Norma Elliott has been on the front lines for 40 years at the Women in Crisis Center in the Sioux.
Have things changed at all over the last couple of months?
It's gotten a little busier.
Yeah.
With phone calls, people a little nervous. Having left situations, about to leave situations.
It's almost always at capacity with women and children seeking safety from violence, but especially so now.
Yeah. Are they more nervous because of what happened?
I think that there's some fear as to, is this going to be safe for myself and my children? So,
yeah.
Inside, past the secure doors, spotless floors, welcoming, plush chairs, shelves lined with toys.
The kids can play over here.
It exudes warmth and safety.
When this first happened, do you remember where you were when you first heard the news?
Yes. I was at a conference, a CEO forum for directors of shelters in Thunder Bay. And we were in a room full of other directors from other shelters. And the word came down what had happened here in Sault Ste. Marie. And it just took us all, it just sucked the air right out of the room. You know, we had a lot of support from the other shelters and directors, but a lot of reflection from them as well as to this could have happened in their community. Most of the shelter directors have experienced a loss within their community. It still hit everybody really hard.
Norma Elliott knows what she wants to see happen.
Well, I think first they need to declare IPV an epidemic. I'm not sure why they're not, why the federal government's not, why they're not saying, yes, this is an epidemic, this is something we need to take serious, and let's put some of those recommendations into practice. And I mean, the recommendations that came out of Renfrew, they're not new either, unfortunately. If you pulled all the recommendations, a number of these would be repetition that's still not happening. It doesn't cost anything, but it does send a message that we do take this serious and we are not going to tolerate this kind of behavior. And then you put your money into making sure that the people that are working the front lines have the money to do what they need to do.
Since speaking at the vigil, Brian Sweeney hasn't slowed down. He spoke at City Council, and in December, he drove 10 and a half hours to Montreal to try and get the Prime Minister's attention to push for national action and more funding for intimate partner violence prevention.
I see this is one thing I believe Canada should be in a leader in. And if Canada makes the change, then the rest of the world will follow.
Closer to home, he wants to see police handle intimate partner violence differently.
She called the cops like one day away, and to the police it was like nothing. To me, I feel let down by the police.
I think it would be impossible not to say that there wasn't a failure.
That's Sault Ste. Marie Police Chief Hugh Stevenson. In the past, he's voiced his support for the Renfrew inquest recommendations well before what happened in October.
The service and the community have been reeling for the last few months trying to understand why didn't we see this? Did we do everything we could to prevent something like this?
He's reviewed the case. Over the years, there were numerous domestic-type calls involving Hallert, complaints about yelling, calls to remove him from various places, but nothing ever resulting in charges.
They were all occurrences that, you know, wasn't something the police could arrest on or remove on. So you don't have a situation where the criminal code can apply.
He's ordered a review of domestic calls that don't result in charges to see if there are grounds for police to proactively approach women to connect them with IPV resources.
We need to think outside the criminal code and use more intuitive, proactive approaches to say, what can we do for this victim? So let's say, for example, we find three occurrences in the last year and we contact through victim services, would you like us to come over and discuss? And I mean, she'll always have the right to say no or yes, and that might end there. But at least we did something. It may in fact be you need a safety plan and you need to get to a shelter. We suggest you do it now. We'll help you do that. Those are all options that we can pursue at that time. Would it have helped in this situation? I don't know. My gut is it would.
Yeah.
It's 7 p.m. in a large meeting room at City Hall. It's buzzing with nearly two dozen people. Most are in blue shirts, emblazoned with the words, Angie's Angels.
All right, guys, so tonight on the agenda, we have a few things.
That's Renee Buxell calling the meeting to order. Seated next to her, fellow Wolfpack member Lindsay Stewart. Amanda Bjerna is here too, along with Brian, his wife Suzanne, Angie's brother, and his wife, They've come together to figure out how they can end intimate partner violence in their community.
We're just over 3 months since all of this happened, and I think some of us are still living in between grieving and trying to put our lives back together, but not wanting to let what happened here just get buried and fade away without actually impacting real change, right? So
it's like tonight's agenda is packed, starting with a conference call with Victoria NDP MP Laurel Collins, whose private member's bill in Ottawa could criminalize coercive control.
We know that when a woman or someone who is impacted by intimate partner violence is leaving, that's the most dangerous time for them.
Then it's to Montreal for advice from Ecole Polytechnique survivor Heidi Rathjen.
So you need to define what you're fighting for. It's really what you're trying to achieve, right?
Their goal is to launch a website and mission statement so the community knows what they stand for. As they listen and plan, Brian Sweeney clutches his wife's hand under the table.
And some idea for committee focus groups. I know that we really want to get our website up and running. We were hoping that
Angie's house, the one four generations of Sweeneys have called home, will likely be sold. The family doesn't want to live here anymore after what happened under this roof. But they're holding on to each other.
What's it been like just watching your grandfather take this on with this energy?
It's been pretty surprising seeing him all over the place. Pretty cool, though. I like what he's doing.
What do you think your mother would have thought of it, of the way that you guys are all coming together and pushing for change?
I don't know. I'm sure she'd be proud, though.
Since I left the Sioux, police there announced the results of their review of the 911 calls made around this incident. They found that Angie had told a 911 operator that Bob had assaulted her roughly 2 weeks before, but that information wasn't passed on to the officer who was attending the call. They say they're now updating their IPV communications and dispatch policy to make sure important information like that is logged and relayed to the people who need to know it, and they're training everyone up. They say they're also going to start routine reviews of calls to make sure that they meet the standards of professionalism, empathy, and decision-making. That's all for Storylines this week. Today's episode was reported by me, Katie Nicholson. It was produced by AC Rowe. Story editing by Julia Poggle and Liz Hoth. Special thanks to Mia Sheldon and the team at The National. A version of this story originally aired on CBC's The Current. Storylines is part of the CBC Audio Doc Unit. I'm Katie Nicholson. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.